Welcome to Popcorn Talk, featuring movie discussions, news, and interviews, presenting the film scene with Ileana Douglas. Ileana is an actress, writer, author, and film historian with a need to discuss movies that borders on obsession. You'll learn the history of movies one great story at a time. The film scene is the deep cuts of movie podcasts, featuring movies we love by the people who made them. And now, Ileana Douglas.
Hello, everyone. It's Ileana Douglas. Welcome to the film scene. I'm here with Jeff Graham. Hello, Jeff.
I am thrilled to be here. You guys can't see, but Ileana's wearing these incredible stockings today. The whole studio is shouting him out. Here we go. We can get a brief. Check that out. Love it.
Thank you.
Yes. You are,
My tights game.
The Office is constantly admiring your style. Your style game is very, very...
Oh, my God. You made my day. Thank you. Thank you.
Absolutely.
I'm going for granny hipster.
I also think that's our new pitch. I think we're taking granny hipster to ABC tomorrow.
I'm taking over where Ruth Gordon, you know, remember all the movies she did, Every Which Way But Loose?
Yeah.
Hipster granny. That's absolutely. me coming to ABC this fall.
Love it.
So what's going on in the news?
Well, what I wanted to talk about, well, first of all, we do have Dee Wallace on today. We should let the fans know.
Oh, my goodness.
Super exciting.
Yeah. I mean, we love Dee.
Talk about what a long list.
Over 200 films.
Incredible. And E.T., I will say, probably my favorite Spielberg movie. A hugely important film for me growing up. And we'll talk about it on air, but I think... I can't think of many films that capture wonder like that film does.
I know. I was telling you up top, I saw it the night before I had to take my SATs. And I was so upset. I should have been studying, but what was I doing? Watching a movie. And we went with a group of people. And I just remember, you know, just it's so emotional. It's just such an emotional movie.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
By the next day, needless to say, I didn't do well on my SATs.
Honestly, if you
were
to
be... But I saw a good movie, darn it.
Well, plus, is looking at your career now, is seeing an important film or studying for the SATs more important for an acting career? I don't know. I think you made the right decision.
Seeing a good movie.
Absolutely.
Darn it.
But what I wanted to chat with you about today was, right when we walked in, we were just chatting, and you were mentioning, of course, you've been working on your book that you've talked about on air.
Yeah. Second book.
You also mentioned that you went to a screening yesterday and you're trying to up sort of your out in Hollywood social scene screening game.
Right.
Which isn't always your first choice, right?
No, because writing is such a solitary thing and I love writing. Mm-hmm. And plus, you know, you want to get things done quickly, even though I'm not the fastest writer in the world. So, you know, you get into such a great routine writing that socializing sort of ruins your routine because you get up in the morning and you write and then I'll go to dance class and then I go back to write and I read what I write in the morning, make my corrections and start again. And so when you have to go out and socialize, it sort of changes kind of everything up. But at a certain point, you know, I'm like, well, it's been quite a few weeks since I've done anything social. So I said to my friend Wayne Fetterman, you know, we did a bunch of social things this week. I love that I have to plan to do social things. But this weekend, he never saw Fellini's Roma. Mm. So I took him to see that. He did not. We lost Wayne almost immediately. We lost him on that. It was too avant-garde, too crazy.
Yeah.
And then we saw FTA, which was a documentary that Jane Fonda and Donald Sutherland made about them visiting Vietnam troops. They had their own variety show, and she was there to present it. So it was amazing.
Wow.
And then I saw a screening for a film tonight called Standing Up and Falling Down. So I said, you know what? I'm going to force myself to go out, and so I'll say I'll report back. But
do you feel guilty? Do you feel though, like with screenings, it almost feels like work because you have to sort of turn on the.
Yeah. It is work. I mean, I'm not. You know, seeing Fellini's Roma or FTA is totally for pleasure. Actually, that is not true.
Yeah.
Because I'm writing, one of the chapters I'm writing about is a film that Jane Fonda was in, and so therefore I wanted to see if there would be any opportunity to ask her about, you know, about that, because I've interviewed her a couple times. So it's sort of, that actually was work. But Fellini's Roma was totally, and Tonight is kind of work, you mm-hmm. know, just because there's a project that I'm involved in, and you kind of want to, you know, you're looking around at casting and mm-hmm. you want to see people. That happened a week ago. I went to see a movie of an actor who I was thinking about, and didn't really like the movie.
Yeah.
So, but you know, you have to see. So yes, it is some work. I don't know if other people, if it's, you know, because I find networking for me doesn't really work.
Right.
But in the process of being out and seeing things, that is networking, because you're aware of what people are doing.
Well, I think for you, there's some talent in Hollywood who the thing that drives them is sort of the chance to kind of get attention and be seen, whereas I feel like your
right.
love of this is art. Like, I do feel like you're in that category of actors who loves it because they love film, they love filmmaking, they love collaboration. So
right.
I guess the networking component for you is a little less on the nose as it might be for other talent.
I always tell young people, you know, that they don't seem to have want as much to learn about, you know, movies of the past. Some people do. It's, you know, it's a generalization. But I always feel that you've got so much more of an inside chance if you know the person's work. Mm. You know, if you go in and audition and you know of 3-4 of the director's films, and an opportunity arises maybe to say, hey, by the way, I like this, or I didn't understand this, or something like that, I think it ups your game very aware of the person's work.
I can't imagine going onto a set and not doing that.
Well, I had a conversation with an actor recently when he was a younger actor, and we were working on something, and he wasn't aware of the person's work, and I said, and I had that same conversation with him, and he said, I think they'd be flattered that I had seen nothing that they were in, because I'm meeting them one-on-one for them. And I just looked at him and I said, you're wrong, actually.
Yeah, I don't get
it's
that.
It's actually really wrong
yeah.
and insulting and arrogant. So,
I think that's I sometimes look at my generation, though, and I think there could be this tendency to, you know, like, that's just sort of like,
hey,
a little bit of a narcissistic approach of like, he'd actually, you know, be flattered if
yes.
I didn't know anything, if I didn't do my research and study his work, you know, like, I don't think so.
I know. Well, because when you go up to someone, you have your opportunity.
Yeah.
It's not, you know, a conversation goes one way in your head, but the person you idolize often changes. You know, I mean, I remember the first time I met Paul Mazursky, I went up to him and I did this long soliloquy about how much I loved Bloom in Love. Mm. And then he said, you like any of my recent movies? And I was totally, you know, I was so thrown.
Yeah.
I was like, no, that was my big in. I had nowhere to go. I thought you'd
Busted.
I thought you'd be thrilled that I knew Bloom in Love. So it was you know, it's a lesson that yeah. you learn, like, oh yeah, don't just, you know, maybe have a whole, you know, anticipate that the conversation may go elsewhere.
Have you ever talked to a director, writer, actor about something you loved of theirs that they did not? Anything that you can think of?
Well, speaking of Jane Fonda, it was delight. She's so, I mean, I idolize Jane Fonda in a way. She's just, it's in the fabric of my childhood, of so many films of hers that I saw when I was a kid, and I admire her so much. And when I was I've interviewed her a couple times, but one of the first times I interviewed her, we were presenting the movie The Way We Were, and I was talking about her Barbara Streisand's hair in the film and how her hair changes, and she disagreed with me completely, openly and defiantly, and kind of was very confrontational about, are you telling me that The Way We Were is about Barbara Streisand's hair? And I said, well, yes, it
is. It's part of it.
But anyway, it was interesting because we had to, we navigated that. And so then the next time when I interviewed her about Clued, and I told her my favorite scene in the movie, she once again said, oh, I hate that scene. How come you like that scene? And I said, well, and, you know, I told her all the reasons. But sometimes it's fun to be able, you know, it's like a true friendship. You're constantly, it was like my friend Wayne not liking Fellini's Roma. Mm-hmm. You know, he gave it a chance.
Right.
But I knew as soon as he started with the religious stuff, I said, okay, we've lost him. But he said to me at one point, he goes, what's with all the heavyset prostitutes? I said, I was like, well, I guess you've never seen a Fellini movie because that's what the whole movie is
about. Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, have you ever had any bad celebrity run-ins, like where they cut you down?
I'm trying to think. Luckily, most of the talent we've had through here has been pretty nice. I think, like, at worst, sometimes you can tell maybe talent's not as warm as you would hope. But I also don't think it's not necessarily an actor's job to have to be warm with you. You know, like if we had an actress on a major network drama come in who I could tell was just not having a great day, and I'm not going to push that person to be someone they're
Hugger.
Not. Yeah, it's like they're – I feel like sometimes it's a production company or an office is actually the chance for someone to come in and feel like they don't have to be hounded and swarmed by, you know, like civilians. They can come in here and kind of be among peers. So
yeah.
Luckily, I do think, especially with, you know, post-Me Too stuff and sort of the changing shift in Hollywood, people are less patient with sort of the entitled ego that comes with fame, you know? It's kind of like we're all in this together. We're all people trying to make things work. Let's just let our guards down and try to just be people, you know?
I feel it is my responsibility to be constantly in a good mood and nice.
Do you?
Yeah. I mean, I, you know, even though I may secretly not want to be there
right.
or think the interviewers incompetent, I feel as if it's not my responsibility to show that. My responsibility is, again, to remember, why am I here? I'm here to promote this movie.
It's true.
And to keep that in mind, or, you know, promote a project. And also to try to use it as an opportunity that sometimes when I don't like people, I make more of an effort to engage with them, because that discomfort then sort of goes away.
I also think I've talked to my wife about this, and I think there's something
marriage problems.
No, it's all good.
I'm kidding.
I just think there's something kind of unfairly gendered about it, because I think when a man comes in and they take themselves seriously, it's like
that's
impressive.
That's totally true.
And with women, it's like, you should be smiling more, you know? Hopefully that's going away, but I think women feel an undue pressure to have to be sunny. And
yes.
My wife talks about that, and I don't know, I have learned to sympathize with that more, as, you know, I've seen it. She's had to kind of play that game, I think, more than I have in this business.
Yes.
Which is totally unfair.
That's so funny. That is interesting. I agree with you. When men are sort of gruff and cold, we just, like, leave him alone.
Yes. He's doing his process. That's his process.
Well, let's get Dee in here.
Yes, absolutely.
I can't wait to talk to her. Dee Wallace, my goodness, she's had over 200 credits. To her name. She's a tour de force, an icon in the industry. Worked with Steven Spielberg, Peter Jackson, Wes Craven, Joe Dante, our friend, Stephen King, Blake Edwards, Rob Zombie, in films like The Hills Have Eyes, The Howling, Cujo, Secret Admirer, Frighteners 10. I can't wait to talk about 10. Of course, E.T. And you're here like a good mom. I'm going to hold it up right in front. Because I don't want you to get mad at me, Mom. Okay, this is your daughter's book. Oh, and ladies and gentlemen, Dee Wallace. I forgot
Hi.
To. And here's your daughter's book, Gabriel Stone, Eat, Pray, #FML.
Yeah.
And
it's great. It's helping a lot of people. You'll read it in 2 days.
And you've written a number of books, too. So I held up the book.
So I know.
You can be happy. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for being here. And we were testing you before. If you remember, we always start the show. If you remember the first movie you saw, and who took you to see it?
It was, and I'm glad you asked me before the show, Lady and the Tramp, and my grandma.
Aw.
My grandma kind of raised me because my mom had to work all the time. We were pretty poor.
Yes, I was in doing my research about you and your mom was actually seemed like a vital force and got you involved in acting.
Yeah.
You were supporting the family when you were a little kid.
Yeah, still am. Old habits die really hard.
Oh, look, there's the lady in the tramp.
The Bubba's. What see, a great and movie. I'm such a dog. I'm a dog fanatic.
Are you going to see a Call of the Wild with Harrison Ford?
Probably, because I love.
I mean, come
Harrison,
on, it is Harrison Ford,
but it's all CGI.
I know.
I'm so glad in Cujo.
I
had the real dogs.
All right, that dog was
13 dogs played Cujo.
Wow.
Yes.
And they were trained within an inch of their lives. Mm-hmm. I'm telling you, those dogs were amazing.
Yeah.
They were all trained to go after toys. We had to tie their tails down because they thought everything was a big game.
Uh-huh.
Right.
It was fun.
And let me tell you, for those of you that are concerned about animal abuse out there, the dogs were taken much better care of than I was. Just saying.
They had their own trailers, presumably.
Yeah, they had a whole barn. And their trailer, their trainer actually slept with them.
Oh, that's
in the
sweet.
Barn.
Wow.
Yeah.
Incredible.
You don't see too many St. Bernards being vicious. That's what's the key to making the movie,
exactly.
I guess, so fun, is that they're, you know, they got that dopey face.
Yeah.
They're docile, really. They're just big lap dogs. They just want to get on your lap and kiss you all over.
It's upsetting. Can't see those dogs. It's but I'm a sucker for any dog movie.
Mm-hmm.
Old Yeller. Oh, my,
oh
God.
My God.
I had to interview. We were talking about interviewing before, and I do work for TCM, and I was interviewing the actress for Old Yeller. It's not really a movie that I enjoy seeing because it's so upsetting, but I had to see it. Man, that's a sad movie, so. But I am looking forward to Call of the Wild.
Anything that isn't good for the doggies, I don't like.
It seems so real. Okay, I have to start off because I love this story. You have to tell everyone about the letter you wrote to Hal Prince.
Oh, my God. Well, first of all, we should set up who Hal Prince is because probably a lot of people don't know Hal Prince was like the biggest producer director on Broadway.
Yes.
Forever.
Yes.
And I was teaching high school in Kansas City, and in the library, we would get the New York Times. And in the New York Times, there was an article about how Hal Prince was looking for an unknown to play a part in his next play. Which was a little night music eventually. And I wrote him the cheesiest, I mean, it was cheesy, letter about just think a little girl from Kansas and you can make her a big star. And I had my brother's friend who had been the photographer for the high school newspaper come out and take a picture of me. I'm going to try. Picture me on a bed, my bed as a teenager, going, and that's the picture I sent to Hal Prince. 3 weeks later, I get a call from his secretary who says, Mr. Prince got your letter and he'd like to fly you to New York to audition for a little night. Now, this is how I was raised. Very poor family. Very religious family, Methodist. And I had already gotten my very cheap ticket. And so, of course, I said he would have flown me first class and the whole deal, right? Oh, when does Mr. Prince need me? And she gave me the date. And I went, oh, well, he doesn't have to buy me a ticket. I've already got my ticket. And I arrive on that day. So I'll just come straight down and audition. I mean, and I'm not a real blonde, you know, but I went and I got down to the last five girls and Mr. Prince said, all right, well, I'd like to hear you all sing. And I went, oh, I didn't know we had to sing. And his secretary went, well, dear, it is a musical. So I said, well, I guess happy birthday. And the accompanist said, what key? And I said, somewhere in the middle. So I didn't get it, obviously. But by the time I left, I talked to all these major gypsies that were there, major singer dancers. And I got where to study singing and where to go for dancing. And I made a lot of, you know, but that was my first day in New York. And I had taken, you know, I had two suitcases of everything I owned. I took him to a cab and I said, "Hi, I have to go down and audition for Hal Prince. Could you take these to this address?" And they got there.
There you go.
And they got there. And, you know, that's just kind of my life. I'm a big believer in naivete. Because when you're naive, you don't set up a lot of walls for yourself. You just go in this kind of blind belief. And I would go get coffee and meet a guy and he said to me, "Oh, you're new in town, right?" And I said, "God, what do I have it pasted on me that I just got here from Kansas?" And he sat down for 2 hours in the coffee thing and showed me the layout of New York and how to take the buses and how to take the subways. He said, "You've got to get an answering service," because back then, in the olden days, we didn't have cell phones.
Right, so, the answering service.
I mean, I just was led every single solitary step all the way.
Now, did you ever see Hal Prince again to tell him?
I did, actually, out here. I saw him at a play that I went to. And I went up to him, again, the naivete, and I said, "Mr. Prince, you probably don't remember me." And he said, "Yes, I do. You sang Happy Birthday."
Oh, my goodness.
Blow your mind.
Wow.
Of all the people that he saw in his career, I must have made quite an impression.
I'm sure you did. I'm sure it was adorable. Came from Kansas.
Oh, my God.
Now, when you were in New York, you studied with Uta Agan.
Mm-hmm.
Another name that people don't, when I got to New York in the, like, 1983, so Uta Agan was still teaching that.
Berghoff Studio.
Yeah, Berghoff Studios.
Yeah.
I studied with Sanford Meisner, so he was around.
And I studied with Charles Conrad, who came out of the Meisner.
Oh, he did.
Studio. Yeah.
Because that's what I was going to say. Later on, you mentioned him, too. So those were your kind of two... Acting.
And Jeff Corey.
Jeff Corey, too, yeah. Another name.
But
people...
Charles really was my mentor, who literally changed my life as an actress. I just have one of those minds that the more you try and figure stuff out, the worse you get. It's true. I don't break things down. I don't look for beats. He taught... this incredible technique where you really kind of channel the character.
Yes, so I wanted to know, what does that mean? Because, you know, Peter Sellers said he channeled, but of course when he said it, everybody thought he was crazy, you know? But I kind of understand in some ways what you mean, but you don't literally mean channeling like Shirley MacLaine, or maybe you do.
I do, actually. And things would happen every day in class.
Mm-hmm.
Where, and Charles had a rule that you weren't ever supposed to do a piece of material that you knew, because he didn't want any ideas. And people would get up, like, I'll give you one of my personal stories. I got up and I got my energy up and I was sitting down. And then I got up to walk over to my partner, and I was limping. And he stopped the scene. He said, "Dee Wallace, I told you, you're never supposed to do a piece." I said, "Charles, I've never seen, I don't know what it's about." He said, "It's about a cripple woman, and you're limping."
Wow.
I mean, stuff like that happened every class.
Uh-huh.
Every class. And then when I became... a clairaudient channel and knew that I was a clairaudient channel, I went, "Oh my God, I know what this is. I've been doing this in my acting like forever."
You read about Peter Sellers? Because this is
but I'm gonna nail.
This is exactly what he says. He says if former actors would come to him while he was performing and give his performance.
Oh, well, I wouldn't go that far. That's not what happens to me.
Yeah.
But I would pick up the energy of the character.
Mm-hmm.
And Cujo, E.T., all my big movies, that's the way I worked. And for me, it was freedom. It was joyful freedom now with acting, because I never had to worry about, am I making the wrong decision? You know, am I going the wrong way or the right way or mm-hmm. the in-between way? It was just sometimes, well, most of the time, I just didn't have a choice.
So
it
what,
was so clear.
What happens to you? I always think one of the hardest things is right is the moment before the director calls action and those awkward few minutes when someone's touching your costume and your hair and what are the what are you thinking about right before
I don't think
you don't think
I,
at all
I really try not to think and just be, because when I just am, I know what to do.
Mm-hmm.
when your monkey mind gets in there, like in life, you know, your monkey mind is really designed to question and doubt. And you know that's death for an actor and for people, actually. Mm-hmm. So, and I, if it's a real emotional scene, I just say, I really don't care how I look. Get me ready for it, but don't come in and screw around with me right before I shoot, because I just hate it. Don't you hate it?
I do. Well, it's the worst possible thing is usually when you're sort of, you know, you have a scene maybe after lunch or something. People keep, are you okay? And you're sort of semi.
Yeah, in it already.
Welling up a little bit just to sort of test if it's there. And people keep constantly.
Yeah.
Are you okay?
Yeah.
You seem like you're sad. Like, I'm.
He said, really? Have you seen what I have to do in like 15 minutes?
We were talking at the top of the show before you got here how men are given a certain leeway that they can be gruff and standoffish, but women always sort of have to be like.
Yeah, well, I took the guys of liberty a long time ago. I mean, I go out of my. I love my crews. I really love my crews and stick up for them, but. I think bottom line, and, you know, I had one of the largest acting studios in L.A. for like 18 years. And I would tell my students, look, bottom line, it's your face up there. They're not going to say, why the hell did he do that? You know, or why did the director tell her? It's all on you. It's all on you. And you have to be as truthful and as honest as you can be in those moments. That's your job. So when I get a direction and my character slash me goes, I did, and the bugs start crawling all over you, I go, you know, I don't think I can do that. That's just, I can't feel that. Can we talk about, now I've learned to just go, can I just show you what's going on with her? And then if we need to take it a different way, and it's almost always, and yeah, that we'll go with that.
So going back to some of your earlier movies, like The Hills Have Eyes, with working with Wes Craven, when movies were really kind of grittier and...
You think?
You all shared one.
Let's put on a show. Yeah. We all shared one trailer.
I love that.
All of us. And the toilet broke. That was fun. Yeah.
It's like camp.
Truly like camp. And I spent many nights in my car.
During the Hills Have Eyes?
Yeah. And, you know, there was, well, SAG still has this rule, Screen Actors Guild, that you... it has to be within so many miles or they have to put you up.
Exactly.
Right? One more mile, we would have been there from my house. So finally, you know, I was just starting out, but Christopher, who I ended up being married to for 18 years, said, honey, we're just going to, you've got to get a room, because I was exhausted.
Yeah.
We would work all night into the morning and then have to drive all that way home and then drive all that way back. And it wasn't good. It wasn't safe. So I ended up paying for my own.
And I was reading about, I actually briefly worked with, I make a joke, but I worked with Wes Craven. I got a job because I met him at a party, and I made him laugh. And then the next day,
You made somebody laugh. I can't imagine.
Yeah. I wore a sequin dress and it got caught. It's a true story. It got stuck to the couch, the entire, all the sequins.
Oh.
And I asked my friend very quietly to kind of, I said, oh my God, I'm mortified. Please, can you help me undo this?
And can you put your hand under my ass and help me get off this couch?
And he started kind of making a comic meal out of it. And Wes Craven literally, he goes, what is going on? What are you doing? And this whole thing turned upside down. And literally the next day, the producer of this film called me and asked me to be in this movie.
See, now, and that's a Hollywood story.
Yeah.
You know, I got discovered stuck to a couch.
But he was very sweet and soft-spoken. And
oh, incredibly. You know, he was a college professor.
Yes, and not at all, and very erudite, not at all.
Not at all who you'd think would do The Hills Have Eyes.
Completely.
Very, very, and very much a gentleman. I really did like him.
But, and what was his, I, in my one day that I worked with him, I found his directing, that, well, first of all, I met him at a party, so that's already, like, bad. But I went to the movie, I thought I was supposed to be funny, and I went to his trailer, I said, Wes, I got all these things, I'm going to do this and this and this, and he goes, oh, no, very very serious. And I was like, oh, okay, so we were already into problems. But anyway, his style of directing, maybe it was just me, but he was very he got very close to me and was giving me line readings about how he wanted it to be.
Not my experience at all. That's weird.
Yeah.
At least from what I remember. You have to understand that was my first.
Right.
Actually, my second. My first film was a religious film called All the King's Horses with Grant Goodeve, where I played a battered wife. And I love you, Grant, but he got into it so much and he just, and you see me drop to the floor.
Oh, gosh.
I don't hear cut, so I just keep saying the lines. I really didn't even know where I was at. That was my first scene. And so then I jump into from God and religion to horror.
Yeah.
That's kind of sums up my life. Kind of sums up my family. My older brother's an ordained minister who worked his way through seminary shooting pictures for Playboy. That's that's kind of who we are.
I love that.
Yeah.
Gonna Kansas City. But so when you're doing the horror movie, it just feels like it's a family onto its own, though. Is it? It's a completely different style of acting, that or is it for you exactly the same kind of acting?
No, it's exactly the same. For me, unless I'm doing a comedy.
Comedy,
of course.
Horror.
Well, or comedy.
Oh, right.
You know, then it's a whole different genre.
But when you're, so you're doing The Hills Have Eyes, I'm curious again with you know, what kind of direction does Wes Craven give you? Or does he just assume, okay, we all know we're here for a horror movie. You know what to do and I film it. I haven't done that many horror movies. So.
Honestly, well, every director's different. Mm-hmm. In my experience, the bigger the director or the more a director knows, the more they leave you alone. Mm-hmm. And from what I remember, Wes would come in and go, okay, this is what we need to accomplish in this scene. This is what I need you guys to do. Mm-hmm. And we would, I mean, getting the marks so that the camera can follow you while you're being thrown and have a tarantula on you and you're flailing and all that. That was the biggest challenge for all of us and the hours. But he knew exactly what he wanted, but he was pretty hands-off, in my recollection.
Mm-hmm. So then comparing him to our pal Joe Dante. Love Joe.
I love you, Joe.
Now, he's a person who was so in love with horror movies from the 50s, and so much of that is incorporated to all of his movies. and also in The Howling. It's like almost like a tribute to the former.
Oh my
werewolf.
God, he took a film that it could have been a C minus film, and brought it up to a really major motion picture. He paid for all of the flashback.
Yes.
And the cartoons. The studio didn't want to cough up the money. So he paid for all of that. And Rob Bottin, I mean, the way the two of them worked together with Monster. Mm-hmm. Of course, I had no Monster. That was all laid in weeks after I reacted to everything.
But you get to pick your, didn't you get to choose your look, your werewolf look?
Oh, you're talking about the end scene.
Yeah.
The end scene. And that was added after we had finished the movie, and I was up doing Cujo. And they called me, and Joe said, so, you know, we've played this for all our audiences, and everybody wants you to turn into a werewolf. Now, for some reason, it was important back then that you had written in to your contract that you would never have to appear as one of the monsters. And so I had to give them my permission because I had that in my contract. And I said, okay, but, you know, she's fought so hard, Joe. Can you make her a little more vulnerable than the rest of them? And so they came up with this Bambi werewolf.
Yeah.
He and Rob.
She's adorable.
It's all animatronics. Yeah. I'm not behind the makeup at all. But it was such a hit. You know, that little Bambi werewolf with the tear coming down. I mean, The Howling was, it was just an experience all the way around. You know, I did it with my fiancé, Christopher Stone.
And that's a great story, too, that he was not, actually, it's so funny because Joe's been on the show and he told the same story, so you have to do your version of it.
What about which story? There's a million which story.
Well, he has a couple stories.
Rehearsing?
Well, one was about your husband, you didn't tell them, of course, that you were engaged at the time because you didn't think he would get the job.
Oh, yeah. So
that's one story.
Dan Black called me, our producer. Love him. And he said, Dee, we've got a great cast, but we can't find your husband. We're still looking for your husband. Again, not a real blonde. And I said, well, exactly what are you looking for? Well, he's got to be really virile and sexy, but with this vulnerable. And I went, oh, my God, I'm living with the guy they're looking for. But, you know, like that, my brain went, nah, they'll go the other way if you say. And I went, you know, I worked with this guy, Christopher Smith or Stone, some kind of S on Chips. You should have him in. So 4 days later, Dan calls me and I pick up and he goes, Dee? Oh, I must have called the wrong number. You know, that guy you recommended, well, we really liked him and we hired him. And I said, no, you call the right number, Dan. And there was this long pause, and I hear, oh, shit. He said, you guys are going to gang up on me. Actually, in the long run, everybody was going, thank God Chris was on the set, because he knew how to handle a lot of things.
Well, he has the other thing he mentioned that he was scared about was because your husband had to be bitten by another werewolf, had to have at the ritual.
Oh, dear God. The whole crew, the whole crew was like, oh, my God, is Dee going to be a... What she's referring to is he had this huge naked love scene with this she-wolf. And
that's all.
Yeah. And
The Office.
Actress Elizabeth Brooks.
Yes, which Miss Brooks wasn't the. She didn't handle things in the classiest way she could have.
Not the most professional.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. And but you know, I was not. I would never have done that. So one of the girls and I went in town and had a lot to drink the night that he had to do that scene. And he comes hauling in around 4 a.m. And I went, "So, babe, how'd it go?" He said, "Honey," well, I'm not going to demean Elizabeth. He said, it was fine, you know, nothing to worry about, I guarantee you. go to sleep. So, but the whole crew was like, you know, you get so tight with your crew.
Right.
It like you said, it's like a family.
Yeah.
And so they wanted to take care of me. Everybody always wants to take care of me. It's the Kansas, I guess. And so there, yeah, it was a big deal, but it came off perfectly. Isn't that what Joe said?
I think he was nervous about the whole, you know,
film. He came to me. He said, "You're not going to be on the set, are you? Are you coming to the set?" And I went, "Ooh, no." And he went, "Oh my God, Dee, thank you so much." You know, no.
I don't know. It's just fun. I always love hearing, you know, the director's point of view, the actress's point of view. It's always sort of, it's somewhere right in the middle. did you ever work with the writer, John Sayles?
Well, I met John.
Just met him.
And we talked, you know. Yeah. I think we tweaked a couple of things. I can tell you that I did have in my contract that there would be no additional nudity added for any character other than the she-wolf thing, because in my estimation, and I still feel this way, especially in a horror film, it lessens the film. Mm-hmm. It takes it more into the C range. So one morning, really early, we're in the big barn scene, and I'm like already in it. And I walk in and I look up and there's these three or four women with these huge jugs leaning over the edge of the... And I went, "What the hell is this? What is this?" And Joe said, "Well, you know, all the distributors in Europe, they want to see more press." I said, "I'm not doing it. I'm not doing it. I have it in my contract." And so they called Dan Blatt. Now, this is, again, the way I remember it. It's like 4 a.m. in the morning, freezing, and Dan pulls in his little sports car and reeks to a stop, gets out, slams the door, walks in, looks at it, and goes, "She's right, it's stupid. Put something on her," gets back into the car and drives off. That's how I remember it. I'm sure Joe... That's a different memory, but I always love Dan Blatt for backing me up on that.
It's funny that you say this because, again, I remember, you know, now with everything has so dramatically changed. But again, I remember, again, back in the day, be doing a movie, I'm like, what's that? Who's she? Well, we need, you know, and it would always be like some completely useless scene.
Exactly.
That somebody had requested and you never really knew why. And everybody kind of went along with it. That's, you know, it was like it made one uncomfortable. But,
yep. And now we're finally in the hashtag Me Too moment.
I know those things.
And I'm waiting to see how much changes.
Yeah.
So let's go on to a homespun film like E.T.
Small little movie.
Da, 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 da. Yes.
It ruined my, I was saying at the top of the film, it was the night before I was supposed to take the SATs. And instead of studying, what did I do when I went to see a movie?
I ruined her life.
With my friends.
I said it was better for her to be studying film than the SAT because look at her career.
Yeah,
so.
And then we walked around. You know, it's kind of funny to say that in a weird way it's true because we were actors. We were in like local theater. I didn't wait, you know, and we all went to see the movie and then we walked around, talked about our future. You know, I was the only one who actually stuck with it. But so I didn't take the SATs too seriously the next morning. Kind of did really badly.
I didn't even let my daughter take him. So.
It's an interesting story how you didn't have to audition for E.T. You were offered the part because...
I had auditioned for Used Cars.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I love Used Cars. That's a great little film.
Well, it ain't E.T. So if I had to choose, classic. I would have said, yeah, E.T.
You know, it's funny you mentioned there's another nudist. There's a scene in Used Cars that it's like, wait a minute, what's comfort? There's nudity in Used Cars for no reason, again and again.
You but know, I really classic. Had to actually kind of fight Stephen. The scene where E.T., I mean, you don't ever fight Mr. Spielberg, but I voiced my very strong opinion when E.T. comes into the bedroom and he drops the little Reese's Pieces and I'm asleep on the bed. Well, he wanted the cover down to my crack. I don't know how else to say it. And I said, Stephen, no, this isn't right. It's a family film. Mm-hmm. I don't feel right about this. You know, yeah. I mean, I didn't feel right about, yes, I was upside down on the bed, so you didn't really see anything, but I felt really strongly about it. And from my memory, Melissa Mathison and Kathleen Kennedy kind of agreed. And so we compromised, and I think that it ended up here. But, you know, he does do that in a lot of his films. Poltergeist, the parents are smoking pot. I said, yeah, but that's a horror film. That's a whole different thing than this family film that opens people's hearts. And, you know, and I really would love to write a book about all the amazing stories people have told me about how that film has changed their life. It's
yes,
unbelievable. I had a mom come up to me with tears, and she said, Ms. Wallace, I want you to know you were a miracle in my life. I have an autistic son who's 10 years old, and I had never heard him speak a word. And I took him to see the re-release of E.T., and on the way home, he said every line that E.T. said in the film.
Oh,
wow.
Can you imagine you're driving with your 10-year-old son, and you've never heard a sound come out? We just started crying and hugging each other, but that's the magic of this movie.
It's like iconic, and that what an incredible story. When you read the script, did you just know reading the script?
Oh, sure. Melissa had written such an amazing script, and I had to go over to the studio behind locked doors and read the script. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was very mean. And it was called A Boy's Life at the time. And I called my agent from a rotary phone and said, look, I don't think this is going to do a lot for my career again. but I think it's going to do a lot for the world, and I want to be a part of it.
Mm-hmm. Was there a cast read-through, or did you just go right into shooting, if you remember?
I don't remember, no, because the first day on the set, I think was the first time I met the kids, which doesn't make any sense to me at all. The first day on the set, I was in this high director's chair, and Drew comes up to me, and she says, hi, I'm Drew. I said, hi, I'm Dee. She said, I'm going to sit on your lap now. And I went, all right, Miss Director, come on up. I mean, you just knew right then she was going to be a powerhouse, right? The kids, so amazing to work with. And the two boys and I, you know, do a lot of conventions together now.
Oh, my God. So. That must be, again, people coming up to you endlessly telling you.
With all the stories.
They're
amazing, all of them. Everything from that truly emotional one to, hey, you know, my mom and dad went to see E.T. at the drive-in and I was conceived in the back seat, you know. I hear them all.
That beats my SAT story. You have another great story about, I don't want to give it away, but where you were explaining to Drew Barrymore what, you already know what I'm going to say.
Yeah.
What the death of E.T. might
well,
be like.
Well, so she was waiting on an adjoining soundstage, and I went over to get her because I do become very motherly with the young kids that I work with. And I picked her up and I said, okay, Drew, we're going to go film E.T.'s death scene. But you understand he's not dying. He's just acting like we are. She looks at me and says, I know that, Dee. Do you think I'm stupid? So we walk over there. She takes one. I have to back up from the mic. She takes one look at E.T. and goes, Dee's dying! And here comes the tears. And Steven's going, roll it, right. But when they're 4 years old, they go in and out of reality and fantasy. Sometimes they can't tell. I mean, we had to keep E.T. Stephen chose to keep E.T. alive. Somebody was on E.T. all the time when he was in the corner because Drew would go over and talk to him.
Wow.
So.
Well, the kids are all so open in that movie. I do think I look at E.T. as like a groundbreaking film in terms of what child actors were doing. Because all those performances, I view them in the same league as I would with all the adult performances in the movie. And I feel like before E.T., you didn't see as many just vulnerable child performances. I don't know if you agree with that or not. But
I think that has a lot to do with how Steven directed them, too.
Yeah.
And the relationship and rapport that he made with them on the set. But he it was a game. I mean, he would talk to them and tell them what he wanted them to do. But then it was like, all right, dude, take a bite of your hamburger. Now look at Mary and then look at. Now, say this line, right? So they couldn't get a lot of ideas. They couldn't rehearse with their mothers the night before and have locked in a reaction. But Henry and Robert, both just consummate, natural, brilliant actors. And Danny Pintaro and Cujo, I got up every day of my life and thanked God that I got that kid. Because if I got a kid that was hard or wasn't natural or couldn't get there, you know. I mean, it's him and me and the dog, pretty much the whole movie.
The another great story, to me, E.T. so much is it just creates this world. I mean, I remember I had never been to L.A., and so watching it, I was like, do people really live this way with this cul-de-sac and kids all around? And so the atmosphere that Spielberg created on the set, he even when they were doing the Halloween scenes, he dressed up for
Halloween. My God. Yes, he dressed up exactly in an adult costume as what E.T. dressed, with the hat and the pearls. And the kids loved it.
I can imagine. And another a great story is that you were talking about acting spontaneously, and there was a specific scene where you changed what was supposed to happen. You ended up crying and leaving the scene.
Yeah, the big dinner scene.
And then this is incredible to me that he ended up then building a set to accommodate. So I was wondering if you could tell that story.
Well, again, no ideas. And we're doing this whole dinner scene. And at the end, Henry says, Dad's in Mexico with Sally. And I took such a hit as Mary. And I remember sitting there thinking, I don't want the kids to see me cry. I can't cry in front of the kids. So I got up and left. And that was pretty much the end of the scene. And Stephen came over and he said, why did you do that? What happened? And I said, I explained to him, I didn't want the kids to see me cry. And he looked at me and went, all right, you got 30 minutes. Let's build the set over here so that I can cross her over there to the sink. And I need some running water. And I swear to God, it was like everybody came out of the woodwork, built the set so that he took me over there so he could bring me into that big close-up where I say hates Mexico.
I mean, to me, that is the magic of movie making.
You
right
bet.
There.
That is
to be so in sync, that's an incredible story.
Blake Edwards did the same thing in 10. The scene where I'm watching Dudley play, you know, and I don't know if you've ever seen Dudley Moore play, but it's.
Well, in the movies,
it's emotionally overwhelming. And so all these tears came. First of all, I just loved Dudley. I just loved him as a man and a person. And so these tears, and it happened after Blake yelled cut and everybody started to move. And all of a sudden Blake turned around and saw what was going on because he was still playing and he went, hold everything, bring everything back. And so they got this huge close up of Mary Lewis looking at Dudley playing and how moved she was and everything, which added a whole different element to the relationship and the characters.
Yeah.
You know?
That was going to be my next question, was about working with Blake Edwards, just an incredible director.
Well, probably our most, at that time, certainly, iconic producer, writer, director. He did everything. And they had looked for Mary Lewis for weeks. And this was their last day. He said, we've got to find somebody today. And Lynn Stallmaster happened to see my Lou Grant, where I played a hooker, on the night before. And so they called me that morning, sent the scenes over. Thank God for Charles Conrad's method, because I was in heaven. I didn't have time to break anything down or study anything. I tried to get the lines down as much as I could. And they hired me by the time I got to the car. And Blake was a father figure for me.
In what way? I mean, just...
Well, just in his guidance, in his... He was very gentle with me. And he so brilliant. So I'm sitting on the bed. Okay, let me set this up, because I have not been out of Kansas very long, right? And you can take the girl out of Kansas, but, you know. And he came over and sat on the bed, and he said, so, Dee, what do you think about doing this nude? Well, my, you know, heart dropped down to my feet. But I thought, oh, keep it together, Dee, keep it together. And I said, well, Mr. Edwards, I don't think it's right for the part, because, I mean, he hasn't been able to get it up, and I don't think I'd flaunt everything in front of him. And I think she's really vulnerable at that point and wants to cover herself up and hide. And really, bottom line, I make my living doing commercials right now. If you want to guarantee me another movie, I'll try. And he looked at me and he went, just thought I'd ask, honey. But he knew, it threw me off just enough that the whole scene was kind of
interesting.
Yeah, yeah.
To kind of,
and he took me aside afterwards and sent me over to Marty Baum was his big agent, and they looked at all my stuff. I had a lot of movies of the week and stuff, and brought me back in. And Marty said to me, "You know, Dee, you're one of the best actresses we've ever seen. Come back when you're making $500,000 a year." And I said, you know, Mr. Baum, when I'm making $500,000 a year, I won't need to come back. And like 8 months later, I signed the contract for E.T.
Did you go back to Marty? Or
no.
You, no, screw him. What was this?
Well, you know, if somebody's not going to believe in you in the beginning,
yeah,
it tells it tells you who they are.
Yeah. It says more about Blake Edwards than it says about. But I love that he believed in you enough to send you, you know.
He couldn't take responsibility for, how they were gonna.
The I've never gotten to ask. I don't think I've interviewed too many people that have worked with Blake Edwards. What kind of an atmosphere did he have on a set?
Well, it was very interesting because I probably have a whole, I can tell you, I have a whole different experience than John Derek, who was not allowed ultimately to come onto the set in my memory. I love Bo to death, loved working with her, but he ran a really tight ship. You did not walk on that set if you didn't know your work. Mm-hmm. There was no, he had absolutely no time or inclination to be patient with you mm-hmm. if you didn't come as the professional he expected. So, Blake, at that time, it was the very first when we started using monitors instead of the director watching your performance on the set. And so he would go around the wall. Can I swear on this show?
Yeah, it's okay.
Okay. He would go around to the other soundstage. And I remember, because I was just... I was hanging on for dear life trying to follow Dudley Moore. It was just, and I was like trying to be in the moment, you know. Sometimes there were lines that were written and then he'd go off and then I'd go off and then we'd come back. But we had such a connection. It just worked. And we finished the first take and nobody spoke until Dudley spoke, until Blake spoke. And we heard, I don't know who the fuck wrote it, but we're going to print it. And he, of course, had written the script. But, you know, one time I was having problems getting to an emotion, and he came over and he said, how can I help you? Wow. And I said, could you just hold my hand? I'm about to see the tears come right when I think of it. And he went, yes, darling, I'll just sit here with you. And boom, there I was. And then we start. You know, that's a good director.
He cares about actors.
Oh, he cared so much about actors. Wow. Yeah. But also, he happened to be walking by one time and the sound guy was asking me to speak up because I do get kind of soft, especially in emotional scenes. And he stopped and he said, excuse me, what'd you just say to her? And I'm going, oh, dear. And I backed up a little bit. He said, well, you know, I'm just having a little... He said, you don't talk to my actors. You don't ever redirect him. And you don't ever tell him to talk up. And if you can't get it, I'll get somebody else.
Wow.
And I went, and scene. You know, it was kind of scary, and also at the same time, I really respected him for that, because it can really change your performance, you know?
It's got a point. You've done so many, I mean, do you have a favorite? Is from 200
Cujo
credits is your favorite?
Yeah. Not to do, but I just feel that I went as far as I could go, as truthfully as I could go there in that movie. It just about killed me, that movie, too.
Well, I can imagine. It's a tour de force, you know.
Especially with your method. You know, you've talked about actors have different approaches. You know, some really like to embody the character when action is called and then let it go uncut. And it sounds like your method is so open. And you kind of mentioned there's like a clairvoyant component. You've done a lot of horror. You've done a lot of dark stuff. Is it hard to let that go when cut is called? How do you...
It used to be.
Yeah. How do you work through that? We have a lot of actors who listen, so...
Well, I have to tell you, a lot of people don't realize that your brain doesn't know you're acting, your body doesn't know you're acting. Mm-hmm. So chemically, when you're in fight or flight for 8 weeks, all of your chemical body is shifted and changed and screwed with. Totally blew out my adrenals. I'm still on adrenal supplements.
Wow.
Probably won't ever get off them now. Because it just it just depleted all, you know, literally I was running from danger for 8 weeks and getting not enough sleep and in really tough conditions. Everybody goes, oh my God, you poor thing. It was so hot. No, we were freezing on that set. I finally asked him to put a heater in the front of the car because I looked over and Danny's going,
oh,
because he was had his shirt off. He was in his little shorts, you know, and it was tough. It was a tough, tough shoot. I was supposed to have a break for a week after the car stuff, but the weather was coming in and it all the bad weather was coming in earlier than we just couldn't take a break. So I remember going out to dinner. Some of our close friends came up because Chris, as you know, played my lover in it.
Yes.
That's a whole story in itself. And we were at dinner and I fell asleep on the table. I mean, it was just, I had nothing. I had nothing left, you know. But that's, yeah, that's my favorite.
You said something which I find hard to believe because I want to spend a little
bit
of time because I know you are. I saw your TED talk, which everybody should check out on YouTube, and you've written books sort of in the self-help realm. And maybe you feel differently now, but you were saying after that you did ET that there was a part of you that felt that you didn't deserve to have this success and the accolades.
Oh, for sure. Because you have to understand a child's brain around...
And this is something that's in your TED Talk.
Well, it addresses how our little child within us is literally running the show. We all want to know why we keep hitting the walls. We keep think about your childhood from the time of conception through 7 or 8 years old. Around your self-esteem and how you see yourself in the world and how you see the world seeing you, totally locked in your brain by 8 years old. Mm-hmm. So I love my family, but what I was taught is you should never have more than you need. You shouldn't have too much. You have to work really, really hard, and then maybe you deserve to get what you get. So cut to, you know, D at 31, and I just done ET and gotten paid more money than probably my mom and dad ever thought they'd see in an entire lifetime. And everybody wanted to interview me, and the little girl in me went, go hide. Go hide. It's not okay. You know God's not going to love you if you're this big. You know everybody's judging you because you have more than everybody else in your family. And yeah, it was, I think it was one of the biggest reasons that I entered the healing world and wanted to really know why part of me wanted this so very much and part of me was fighting me against having it. And I can pretty much guarantee not only actors, but that's running all of us. Mm-hmm. That fight, that conflict between I want to own all my power and it's not okay to be powerful.
Mm. Wow, that's amazing. Well, I can't think of anything else except to get your and some of your books that are also available too.
Yes.
That you've written. You've written 5 books.
I've written 5 books. Conscious Creation is all channeled about the creation process. Bright Light is really my autobiography told through all the big films and directors I've worked with and the spiritual lessons I've learned along the way. Yeah, it is. Especially if you're in the biz, you really enjoy that and relate to it. A lot of actors go, oh, that's why I'm, you know, and that's why I'm so proud of her book as a mom, because I taught her and raised her in this empowerment. Always look to yourself. Don't point your finger about why you can't or they're the reason why or that's my excuse out there. To take responsibility. And when she went through this horrible divorce and got dumped by somebody else, she went to Europe and found out how to love herself again. Mm-hmm. And how you can actually take concrete steps to find that love for yourself again. So she's passing it on. I could not be more proud that she wrote this book, taking the work that I've taught her and expanding it out into a really fun, I mean, hashtag FML, you know it's not straight and narrow, right? She had a lot of publishers that were interested, but they wanted her to take the F word out. She said, no way, this is what it's about, right? This is who I am. This is my power. And she sold thousands now. Mine and hers are all available on Amazon.
Did she write, so when they make it a movie, did she write you a part in the...
Probably on the phone, right?
Still counts.
Hi, Mom, can you send me... Yeah.
How would you feel about nudity now? You know, would you be game enough, you know, with all the...
Now? No, I don't do nudity now, no.
Well, sometimes you see people, Diane Keaton is, you know, she's kind of done.
Well, good for her. No, I've done a couple of movies with nudity when I had the final say over the scene. And mm-hmm. I thought that it was really needed.
Right.
In, you
if
know.
It's needed, if it's
yeah,
tasteful.
But come on. No, at my age, I'm not doing nudity. I mean, no.
All right,
I'll kill anybody, but yeah.
You'll suck their blood or you'll be a she-wolf, but no nudity. Dee, thank you so much. It's just been a delight.
Like, for hours, I could go on with you guys.
Oh, please.
It's so easy and
goodness.
Fun.
Come back. Everyone here is so excited. All our fans, too. But so please come back anytime. It's been a thrill and an honor.
Thank you.
And as we always say, end our show by saying everyone's life is like a movie with a beginning, a middle, and an end. And today is the end of our movie. Thank you so much, Dee. Thanks, Jeff. Everyone have a great day. So long.
Thanks for tuning into The Film Scene with Ileana Douglas, airing exclusively on the Popcorn Talk Network. We bring you this show for free because we're just as passionate and borderline obsessed with film as you are. And it would mean a lot if you would please subscribe to our podcast and give us a 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts. It takes 5 minutes to review the show, but it helps other film junkies find the show and continue to spread a love of classic and contemporary film. For guest inquiries or live bookings, you can email me, Jeff Graham, at guests@afterbuzztv.com. That's guests@afterbuzz.com. For more incredible film content, check us out online at The Popcorn Talk, and we'll see you after the credits.